Today is April 29th, and I'm here in Tbilisi, Georgia, with Eka Tekeshalashvili. Eka, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
If you wouldn't mind, could you just briefly cover the position you have at the moment with the government and your history of your involvement with policing and security affairs here?
Currently, I'm the National Security Advisor of Georgia, so I'm not really directly engaged with the police, though the Minister of Interior is part of the interagency coordination processes that we run through the NSC. But I've been Deputy Minister of Interior for quite some time in my previous career, so to say, so I have a bit of a 2 years experience almost being with the police at that time as a deputy minister.
And as I understand it, you were deputy minister in 2005.
Yep.
So this was after the current minister Mrabashvili had taken over at the end of 2004.
Yes. I mean, the current minister was already a minister when I became a deputy minister.
So could you maybe describe the state of the ministry when you were working there in 2005?
Well, it was already in the process in which the first wave of reforms had happened, in a way, so that the major structural reorganization of the ministry was already at place. The patrol police was already reformed at that time. I mean, the beginning of the restructurization, so to say, of the process. But at the end of the day, we were very much engaged at the time in finalization of what would have been the final structure of the ministry, working with the European Union at the time, what would have been the human resource management mechanism in the ministry, how would the reform in different sections of the police could proceed even better than it was at that time, with better training, integrating all the elements of, you know, including human rights, for example, and then some special skills that the police should be in a possession to have. So the academy was a big focus at that time as well. So we've been in the process of coming up with the new curriculum for the police academy at that time. There was the new head in the academy at that time. We've had a big project with the assistance of the U.S. government at that time to have a new technical facility for the academy being built, so that it would have had all capacities needed, basically for training purposes and for housing purposes of the students as well. So we've established at the time new procedures for getting people recruited in the police, you know, transparent but sophisticated entry exams for them with good interviews as well, so that, you know, people would have had a good trust in the system in a way. So everybody who would have been on a merit base deserving to be in, they would have had a fair chance of getting in the police in that way and getting jobs and being well trained.
There's a lot there that I'd like to return to, but firstly, as I understand it, there was a Ministry of Internal Affairs reform agency briefly under the first minister, Baraminte. Once you were at the ministry, was there such a coordinating body, or was it more ad hoc?
Not really at the time, because we were already a well-functioning institution, but institution having an understanding that we had to do, you know, much more again to be, you know, developing more and more in a way, so that we had no self-satisfaction that we've achieved already at that time, a good level of development, and there was nothing to be added to that. So in a way, there was no need of, you know, super big, some coordinating bodies, which usually then take too much time, I mean, if you don't really need to have that much of coordination at the time. So it was a very much working process on individual projects with different organizations, some, you know, partner countries that were engaged in different fields of development of the police at the time.
And one thing you mentioned was human resources management was an issue. That's a problem we come across in a lot of different countries. Could you talk a little bit about Georgia's situation with that?
Yeah, Georgia's situation still, I mean, it encompasses the whole civil service, I think, not only the police in that way, because we had to break up with the legacy of the Soviet Union in that way, which was not well-developed guidelines of what is the career development for a person, and then appraisals of persons, and then, you know, getting a management system in a way in which you know how you actually recruit people, and then how you manage the people, and then have good stimulus for them to develop themselves, and then, you know, have a good appraisals who is good and who is not bad, so that you know properly on that. And it was pretty much the beginning of the process for us at that time in every other institutions as well. So we've taken quite a bit of an experience from European countries in that way, and then from America as well, to see how, you know, different sections of police do operate differently again in different countries. I'm not sure as of now whether or not we are again fully satisfied that the system that we have now is finalized completely, because throughout the system we always identify what could be the ways of further development. But what is already good fundamental to the human resource management system is, again, in our context, a very important beginning of the process, which is fair and well thought out recruitment process. Because if you don't have transparent and fair system how you recruit people, it's very difficult ever to have an expectation that you can really deal well with corruption and fight with corruption and have an expectation that it will be a good motivation and quality with the people who get in, because otherwise there's no real respect to the job they do. They know that they've somehow got improperly into the service. So that's something that played a huge role to the system. Then the training factor to the human resource management, so that it's not only the entry training, so to say, after the recruitment, so that you are prepared for 2 or 3 months as a professional again to start fully then your job, but then continuous education for people, so that from time to time different type of trainings in different themes, anti-terrorism, that be, or you know, money laundering and different type of crime, so that it's not a generalist way of having, you know, just theoretically good trainings, but very practical trainings for people who actually do different type of, you know, job in police. So it's very much diverse and not unified. Different sections of police get different training based on the stuff they do in that case. So that's another big component of the human resource management, as much as I see myself, and I think that my view is shared in that way by my colleagues as well. And then the next step that comes in, it's more of a durable career development for a person there. This is something that we're still working on, because we're still a young democracy in that way, a country who struggled for past years to get out from the, you know, non-existent dysfunctional states context in a way. So human resources that we've had were quite restricted, so we had people moving in different jobs and then doing different jobs frequently, so it was not a classical career development in the police as well. So for some people promotions were much quicker than otherwise it would have been expected, because there was no basically pool of ready at hand human resource right away for all positions at that time. So it was a very quick development of career path for people at that time in the police, which is settling now more or less. And then now I think it's the, you know, proper time already to have more finalized way of you know, having career development system being having it placed, like good appraisals for the people, knowing what is the classical way for you to develop your career since you entered the police. It's pretty much defined in fundamentals now when you enter the police for a person. No, but it can be even more developed then after some time.
Now, in some sense, the end of the career cycle came first for Georgia with the massive dismissals that
yes.
happened.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about how that was managed? And because what we encounter is that this is a large pool of people of a certain skill set and a certain set of experiences that, mm-hmm. when not managed well, can be problematic. So,
at that time, I think it was a very quick and right away drastic step that we've undertaken. Basically, quite many people from the police were dismissed at the time from their jobs. And they had a choice to stay at the time, as in other offices as well, but then they knew that if you would have stayed and then throughout the individual investigations or inquiries, the facts of corruption and then ill treatment of people would have come out, they would have had repercussions on that. So it was more or less a silent deal in a way, as much as I can recall now. I was not with the police at that time myself, and then not even with the government, but as much as I remember, as a citizen, everybody had this understanding. People knew what they were doing throughout, you know, decades of their work. I mean, being engaged not only the corruption cases, but then in torture cases and ill treatment of persons, so that you know, they knew that their time was over by being part of the system, so to say, and they left. It was a deliberate choice not to experiment on that, whether they could have improved or not, because and I do believe myself now quite firmly that if a person for a continuous period of time is engaged in misbehavior of that type, which is criminal by nature, you can't really bet that this person can improve that much, that you can have a fair expectation that the performance of this person will be fair in the future of the job. So, and it proved to be the right choice ultimately. We've never had any big disturbances or implication of these people en masse, so to say, in criminal activities outside of their service, because in the service they were pretty much criminal, engaged in criminal activities as well, by being engaged with organized crime as well quite heavily. So they just sort of, you know, left in a way. So socially and from criminal point of view in a country, we've had no drastic change of the situation because they were out in the market, maybe ready at hand for some other criminal activities. And on the other hand, there was a big public approval of that as well, because, I mean, largely the public and society was behind that decision as well. It was not something that needed to be explained that much even to the population, because when, you know, law enforcement was one of the main parts where people were so unhappy at the time with the government.
And so then when it comes to recruitment, I imagine the initial challenge would have been that there's a very small pool of people with applicable experience. Mm-hmm. So how did you really set criteria for hiring people to police or Ministry of Internal Affairs positions?
Well, there were different criteria which got more sophisticated along the time, obviously, with the type of requirements that we have now for the patrol police, that we are criminal police and other sections of the police. But extensive experience in the police was obviously not a requirement at the time, because that would run contrary to the whole context at that time. We were looking at what type of educations people have. There were some two tests made for them based on general education a person could have had, including some which would reflect their just logical thinking as well, how much they could have universities. And for the patrol police, I mean, because for criminal police, you still have to know the criminal law much more intensely rather than when you enter the patrol police in that way. So it was a different entry criteria at the time. And then some aspects from administrative law at the time, which were more relevant and continues to be more relevant, but patrol police rather than criminal law in that way. And interviews in terms of seeing, I mean, how through the interviews people would have performed, and the physical exercises as well. I mean, the capacity to be in the patrol police, because patrol police was the biggest one who was right away largely reformed. So, and then we were inquiring very much again any information that we could have get what this person was doing prior, so that anything that would have been with relation to anything of with relation to corruption or anything of bad behavior, so to say. So if that was anything, I mean, even a tinted more or less with corruption, I mean, we would never risk that much for that.
And it's my understanding that while the vast majority of, take the traffic police, for example, were dismissed, there were some who managed to stay on in the mm-hmm. new force. So it wasn't a blanket dismissal. I was wondering if you had any experience or any knowledge of how that choice was made and what criteria and who made it to keep certain people on despite...
In that case, Shota would be the better person to read, because I might have my own opinions, but I have to be sure that they do reflect reality at that time. Okay. But as I've said, for the criminal police, you have to have people who actually know how to investigate crimes. And in that sense, those who had a chance to stay, they were the ones, as much as I can recall, that had no bad reputation at that time, because, I mean, in such a big system, not everybody was a criminal, obviously. And then there were people who were known by people that they were not, you know, the ones who were extorting bribes and then, you know, mistreating persons. And they had a chance to stay, and then they had time to prove themselves, and then there were people who didn't prove themselves in a well manner, and then they were then prosecuted for future, so to say, cases in which after they've retained their jobs they still engage themselves in some improper behavior. But then I would say even the majority of the ones who stayed at the time, they proved themselves that they've readjusted to the system in such a way, so they are in a good shape.
So because of the functional specificity of groups like the criminal police, mm-hmm. as opposed to the drastic cut in traffic mm-hmm. police, this was a more drawn-out assessment of these individuals.
I would say that, logically that would be the main reason at the time, because if you right away blankly dismiss the whole criminal police, that it's very hard to substitute that in that way.
And then in terms of, you've mentioned a couple times appraisals and promotions. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the Shevardnadze era ministry, from my understanding, it's not rationalized by any degree. This was
Mm-hmm.
a much a personal and decidedly corrupt system. What were the ways in which you attempted to actually structure this promotion ladder within the ministry to give people a sense of career destination?
I mean, in the beginning of the process at that time, as much as I remember, we were in the process to when we were writing actually those criteria down together with the European Union experts at the time, what would have been the, you know, human resource management structure. So I'm not really aware now where this stands for, so that needs to be checked. But in the process, meanwhile, we were not really idle in not trying to have some solutions to the situation. So people should have had an understanding that if they would have done a good job, that would have been the only basis for them to get promoted. So mainly for the criminal police, for example, the way how they've dealt with investigations, if, you know, how they've dealt with, you know, big cases, for example, and then on organized crime, and then how their cases were well substantiated and then ready at hand for the court, and then who had the better record than that, they knew that they would have had, you know, if possible, financial aid at the time, either bonuses or either special ranks being accorded to them, or promotions in terms of the positions that they had. So in that way, what we've tried to establish that the whole in the whole context, everybody knew in the ministry, in different sections of it, that it was not up to the to anybody as a given person or, you know, a given boss in a given section to accord better treatment for any given person, but then a performance, so that everybody knew basically why somebody got a good treatment, because they knew that, you know, there was this big case that this guy dealt, for example, and then they've just investigated a very sophisticated crime, and then they deserve that, big money laundering cases, for example. And then the same approach was taken in the prosecutor's office as well, so that the merit-based promotions. But as I've said, it was in a very restricted time frame that was all happening, so that you know, we had to take those decisions before, you know, some well-structured guidelines or procedures would have been set, because the whole context should have been encouraging for good performance for people. So that's how it worked.
And related to this issue of ability to act decisively and also promotion is pay. So
mm-hmm.
a large part of the story with police reform in Georgia is that suddenly police were actually getting
mm-hmm.
livable wages. How was that achieved? Was that because I understand there was international assistance, particularly for those pay,
mm-hmm.
those wage increases?
It was in the beginning of the process, was when a special fund had been created for additional pays to the civil servants of some degree, but not to the whole spectrum of civil servants at that time. But then it's pretty much through the reorganization of our economy right away, because what we managed to achieve is that our economy became, legalized, so to say, when we've dealt with organized crime, and then the way how people through corruption were getting evaded from paying taxes at the time, but paying some portion of what would have been the taxes to some officials in terms of the bribes and all of that. I mean, it had been, you know, a legal source for income for the state budget, but it all was coupled with the economic reforms, with the way how the tax legislation had changed, how the, you know, different system of, you know, encouragement of the economy had been, you know, installed in that way, so that we started to revive in that way. So it was quite soon, already after a year, if I'm not mistaken, when all the additional payments were already abolished by the time for the civil servants. I mean, it was a year or so, I would say. And there was a special fund for some time which continued for, you know, small amount of civil servants, especially in judiciary, for example, in other fields in which, you know, some additional payments were arranged for some people, but then for a short period of time.
On this note of special funds, I have come across this Law Enforcement Development Fund.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that? And
well, it's a different this fund had different sources of income, so to say, and then this fund was specifically created by you know, at that time, for being focused not only on police at that time, but then totally for the law enforcement in a way. So that would encompass in that way the prosecutor's office as well, the law enforcement in general, the police. So and it had been, you know, dealing with numerous projects with infrastructure, and then so, you know, it's not only the salaries and at times some bonuses for good performance that for people could have been arranged, but then We were at the time with no infrastructure, basically, for the law enforcement. So equipment for patrol police, for equipment for criminologists, and equipment for the criminal police, for prosecutors' offices, and, you know, proper conditions for their work. So there was something that really needed an additional effort at the time. So there was a specific fund created which specifically dealt for those projects at that time.
And I've come across references to the fund was largely fueled by contributions from from private individuals.
It was private individuals mostly at the time, but it varied in a way. I can't really say for sure. I mean, what was the percentage in a way, private, non-private at the time? But then in the beginning, I don't know. I have to check. I've never dealt with this issue myself.
And do you have a sense of what the motivation would have been for these? Was it a patriotic gesture, or was there something more structured there?
No, it could have been different. I don't know. I mean, in the prosecutor's office, there will be the ones who will. I mean, police would never dealt with this fund. I mean, as a management or anything, there was a special board who dealt with that. So I've never had an encounter with them that much, as much as I remember.
Thanks. And then, since you mentioned that the prosecutor's office, and I know you've had a lot of experience across both judicial and police, could you talk about the domestic partners within the Georgian government for police reform outside of the ministry itself?
There were several NGOs which from time to time were engaged in different sections of the reform. At times it was legal type of engagement, like the Young Lawyers Association, for example. But then we've had different organizations. I just can't really recall all the names of them. But then some of them who were working on, torture, ill treatment, some of them on the cases of, prisons mob. But then, there's some 48 hours in which the, law enforcement helps a person before the person is presented to the judge, so that the special facilities where persons are being held, so what were the conditions and all of that, and special guidelines for them. So mostly from the human rights perspective rather than from a structural law enforcement perspective, because we've never had a local counterpart who would have really been engaged in police reform as a police reform in terms of the skills and capacities of the police as a law enforcement, rather than from human rights angle only.
Now, in the human rights, was this an advisory role, or was it more of an oversight role that these groups would play?
These groups were more in a sort of special facilities where people are detained before they are presented to a judge and then transferred to the if judge decides so to the prisons. It was an oversight as well, because they had a monitoring function and that they could enter at any time they wished the facilities, and then to see the conditions of the people, to have conversations with them. But other than that, it was more of an engagement in a process, so that when we were contemplating or implementing then set up plans for given field or given subject, that there would be part of it those who wished, so that it was more of a collaboration, so to say, a partnership in that way.
And one body I've come across is, I believe, the Public Defender's Office set it up as a public counsel for monitoring of police activity. I think that was in 2005. I was wondering if that's something you had interacted with and had experience of.
At the time, not really, because I was when I was in the Ministry of Interior, not that much, I would say.
Okay. And so if you were to think of oversight bodies for the police, and I ask this because I think of accountability but sustainability, so if the institutions that will make sure these reforms stay in place, where are the centers of that kind of oversight?
I think it needs to be decentralized. I mean, we've been thinking at that time as well how the local regional setup can be arranged for that, so that local municipalities or the citizens locally, they can be part of the process. Some councils that would reflect the opinion of the people who are actually in a given municipality dealing with a given municipality's police, rather than some central oversight which then in itself becomes too much of a bureaucracy and then not really efficient at the end of the day.
On the point of decentralization, Georgia's in a position where it has certain internal administrative border zones that are potential conflict areas. Could you talk about how that, I'm not sure if it has, but if it has, how does that affect the ministry's decision or strategy for decentralization? Because I imagine those are areas that centralized command also necessarily wants to have a pretty close eye on.
We've already did quite a bit of a decentralization in terms of the giving much more power to the heads of the local police in the regions rather than it ever has been a case. And the same goes with the prosecutor's office. So it's been a parallel action. So there are many issues now that they are pretty much autonomous, including their financial means as well in many ways. So this already happened. Other than that, with the occupied zones now, it's something that we know that we know what the boundaries of those regions are. So they're not really conflict historically again with the regional setup of Georgia in a way. So that it is not really a problem in getting the decentralized way of operation being arranged generally in the rest of the country at least. Other than that, I mean, the ministry's capacity of being in overall coordination of the whole system will always be an important factor for a small country like Georgia, because, I mean, in a way, we are not that big in which you can have almost, you know, fully autonomous regions in such a way, so, you know, they don't really care what happens in another, because they are like small states themselves. It's a different state in a tiny country like Georgia, so regional decentralization gives you a possibility of, you know, well thought out capacity originally, how you manage with the funds that you have, how you better take the interest of the local population in such a way, whether the specifics of the crimes that you might encounter in a given region. But at the same time, when I spoke about the regional oversight, it could be again engagement of the local public with the local police so that, you know, they know what the process is all about and then they are part of it somehow and backing it up. So that could be much, much more effective rather than, again, as I've said, central oversight by any agency in our context, I would say.
Another major departure from the Shevardnadze era was the revitalization of the General Inspection Office within the ministry. Mm-hmm. So that question of internal oversight. Mm-hmm. Could you, did you have any experience with that in your time there, or any opinions that?
I think that it was operating very well at the time already when I came in, so that, you know, functionally it was already very well set up. It was a very autonomous entity within the ministry, directly accountable to the minister only, so that no other department or heads of departments or deputy ministers, including myself, had any influence over this entity apart from the minister. So any complaint from any source, and we've had a special hotline set up at the time for just anybody, citizens, to complain on anything they would wish, was very, very much scrutinized by the General Inspector's Office, so that if they would have come up with any issue that deserved special attention, they would inquire even more deeply, and then all these materials would have gone to the ministers, and then there were, you know, special procedures as, you know, set up under the law what would happen in those circumstances. And that the persons engaged in any case scenario, I mean, they had their own rights that they could have defended. It's not a, you know, totalitarian system in such a way so that, you know, whatever General Inspectors decide, then it's, you know, it's dead end for you. It's the process in which you have a chance to make your own explanations, you can be interviewed orally, and then you defend yourself as well, so that it's, you know, fair process in terms of arbitration in a way. I mean, what went wrong or not with the case that's being investigated.
And another development that I believe happened while you were still deputy minister was the establishment of the neighborhood police. That was in 2005. And as I understand it, that's a distinctly community policing body. Could you talk about the decision or why that was necessary, why Georgia thought that they should have a dedicated unit?
Yeah, because, I mean, for us, as for any police, in a way, prevention is, you know, ultimately much more important rather than reaction on anything when it happens. So with the type of, you know, community policing that one can have in different regions of the country, including different parts of the city, you are in interaction with people in a way, so that you are there as the one who explains what are the provisions of the law, who is just there, who knows, you know, the local people, and then they do trust the guy who appears with them frequently on different activities and just there in the neighborhood. And it's not the policeman out of which anybody can be scared, so that, you know, you don't want to get into trouble, but then person who can ask for advice and then to, you know, to trust in a way. So different ages are better to start up, obviously, a relationship of these types, so that they've tried to be very much engaged with young population in the schools and, you know, in outside of the schools and neighborhood as well. So that was the main reason, so that police is as possible closer with you know, public rather than, you know, a scare factor who's getting in the place when something goes wrong, so that, you know, you don't want not to get into the attention of the police. I mean, partially it's like that in every other country. I mean, as much as one can tell, you don't really want to have an interaction in an intense manner with the police, but yeah.
Now, Georgia's had several bilateral and multilateral assistance arrangements with external actors. That usually, what we find is that usually countries' priorities and the priorities of international assistance programs don't necessarily always match, or in terms of sequencing, at least they don't. Countries may identify something as necessary at the moment, and other actors sometimes come with pet projects, if you will, like community policing, when that's not the most central thing that has to. Could you talk a bit about how Georgia has managed its external relations on this?
It's always a tough job in a way, because it's not like that you know, people come and then, you know, right away want to assist you in a way which is a shared view that you both can have, that is the best way of to proceed. Because in the beginning of the process, again, and then, I mean, in general, maybe there's always much bigger readiness to assist with experience, with, you know, sharing of experiences of other countries, your own, you know, personal experience in that way, rather than, you know, infrastructural or material help that can be coming. And in the beginning of the process of transition, it's always as equally important, even not more, again, to have a proper conditions of work for the people. So I remember myself in the beginning of the process, again, it was always a case that we would rather have a combination of two always, rather than only, you know, technical experience or sharing an assistance, rather than technical assistance, but at the same time something that would bring, you know, a better equipment to the police, and, you know, training combined with equipment which would have been of modern nature at the time. So you always find it more difficult rather than technical experience of the type. But with technical experience in itself, yeah, you always have to negotiate well, so that you better understand again what is meant, that is proposed to you as a form of assistance, but then at the same time your counterpart understands what you actually need, because every country differs from each other. And sometimes for some experts it's difficult to understand. They come to a country, they think that, you know, that there is one model that can be, you know, easily applicable as a default method in different countries, which never works. And then sometimes there have been even more extreme cases when a person, for example, is not able to implement a given model which this person thinks that it's an excellent model in his own country, and then wants to experiment on that somewhere else because there is possibility of doing that. Unfortunately, this happens as well in the countries which are in the beginning of transition. So it takes a lot from the local entities to be well aware, and then professionals as much as possible at that time, you know, to have their own understanding what's best for the country, and then, you know, somehow well balance that. Otherwise, you can have disastrous developments in different segments, for example, in which, for example, I don't know, judiciary, I'm just theoretically speaking, develops under the, you know, model of German judiciary, for example, police, under France, for example, and then some under the US models. And then in the end of the day, you have systems in which all parts of the system have to well collaborate with each other, but then they have different systemic approaches to different things, and they can't come together well. So if a local counterpart is not really mobilized, and then knowing how they, I mean, envisage themselves the development of a given field, and while we speak about law enforcement, it's pretty much the system of the system of justice in general, in which you have prosecutor's office, police, you have judiciary, you have the penitentiary, so that you have to have a vision for a comprehensive thing if you want to be well arranging reforms in a given field, like police, for example.
Now, did you find your international partners were willing to coordinate amongst themselves? Because a lot of times you find this duplication.
I think that they did. I mean, from maybe in the beginning they've been themselves, I mean, some small sort of a competition, but then at the end of the day they pretty much settled well. I think they have had their own boards of coordination, and then we've had some common boards in which, you know, recipient agency together with the board of international agencies would have had meetings. So yeah, they've tried to be not duplicating each other, because ultimately that was beneficial for them as well, not to spend money on the same thing over and over again in a way.
Now, any reform, and especially when it comes to agencies of force, requires tremendous political capital expenditure. Where were the main allies for police reform? Where was the center of support for this, the driving support, when it
You mean
came
internally?
internally, yeah, when it came up against the inevitable
I think there were
problems?
two factors. One was the public itself, because it was just the thirst for change in this country, because people were fed up basically with the way how the state was dysfunctional, and how the state was not only dysfunctional and by that not providing what it has to provide to the citizens, but then how state was, interfering too much with private lives as well. So all those changes were highly expected and demanded by the public, and that's why, I mean, it has been the main political force that backed up all these reforms. And it was, on the other hand, it was the courage and unified vision that the new government had, because we understood at the time as well, because along the way, when you implement the reforms of the type, you lose the same political backup that you have from the public, because there will be painful processes. And then when people do actually understand what it means to go through the reforms, when, you generally, for example, are in favor of the police reform, but if your cousin loses job in the police, you might be more critical of that. And then, examples like that. And but we knew that, but then it was a conscious decision for that's something where we came to the government that we had to do in all fields, including police at that time. So it was already a vision and courage from the new political force that came in, and then, but at the same time, the public itself who demanded that.
So, as you said, challenges in a sense will inevitably come up. I was wondering if you could think of what were in your experiences the real challenges here, things that Georgia foreseen or unforeseen that.
Well, the main challenge again was a very restricted time for us, and the beginning of the new experience for all of us, because most of us, we were not governmental people when we came into the government. We've had experiences in different fields, and that's why we've been brought in. But at the same time, we had to work it out for the reform processes in the country, and then to do it quickly in a way, because we've been working around the clock for 7 days a week basically. And then again, you have all this international assistance again coming in with different stories. What could be the better one? You have to choose, and it's not that easy again to do everything without mistakes. So that after some time, we would identify that in a given field, we would thought that that was a good arrangement, but then we had to change it a bit. For example, what could have been, for example, the training curriculum, who could have been longer or shorter in a way, what could be the subjects that could be in, and then the interaction with the public as well. For example, when the neighborhood police came in, it was again an understanding that we had to make the step at the time in order to re-engage again with the public in well manner, so that again the beginning of the new story of the new police would not have been lost, and then people would have had an understanding what we were doing as part of the society in a way. So different examples of that type.
So we've covered a range of issues, through from hiring to broader reform ones. I was wondering, is there something that strikes you that we haven't touched on that people should really know about the story of police reform in
I
Georgia?
think that one of the big part of the stories again is a special context in terms of the organized crime that we've had, and it was not only a post-Soviet context that we've had to change and to make the system functional in a proper way, but then really free this country from the organized crime, which was part of the system, of political system even. And then it was a double life that the country had, dysfunctional state, but then very well functioning organized crime. And people were very much tied into this, parallel systems of development. And it was very difficult to do anything here, any business, because I mean, it was, as official taxes, I mean, people would know how much they would have paid, who would have had differential, treatment on anything. And it was, especially after the conflicts in the 90s, too much weapons around and everything. So for police, for the young police at the time, it was a huge burden to tackle with this issue, and for the prosecutor's office and for judiciary as well. And with the way how new legislation had been enacted at the time, which very much resembles RICO Act, and which had been well implemented, and then police had been trained, and being courageous enough at the time, frankly, to deal with those criminals, because at the time nobody had guarantee who we are tackling with these big guys, what would happen with them or with their families. But then, you know, this was the new drive and new motivation in the police, and new dedication for and respect for their job, for themselves. And that helped a lot, because, I mean, these days I can really freely say that, I mean, this country is free from any organized crime. I mean, from, you know, different crimes, they happen all over in different countries, but it's a free country from any organized crime this time. And this is the huge part of this, you know, story in a way, how throughout the reforms and being doing everything at the same time, these guys were dealing with real huge problem at the time with the risk for their lives and security.
On this question of organized crime, I've heard it kind of described as a carrot and stick approach, where there's the stick of a zero tolerance policy, mm-hmm. but there's also an option of sorts, and again I've heard it described as the plea bargain option, where people would in effect admit to some wrongdoing and revert the corrupt monies back to the
but
state.
But with the plea bargaining, it was never with the big organized crime guys in a way, because those were the people who were engaged in big corruption cases, you know, money laundering even, or, you know, criminal cases mostly, and then mostly with the corruption cases at the time, because when investigations went on and then this information came out and then they knew that they were under investigation and they knew themselves the best again what they did actually. Plea bargaining was an efficient way of dealing with the situation. You could have had dragged this process throughout the whole court system, but then if basically there is a deal, plea bargaining deal can be made. And it's the same logic while plea bargaining exists as you have it in your own country as well. So that was more with different type of criminals, because at that time, you know, big criminal guys, they were so much influential that, you know, plea bargaining for them, I mean, it was not an option. So it was pretty much a very tough process with relation to, and they were quite violent for quite some time. I mean, so.
And my last question on this issue of the violent legacy of the 90s, a lot of states, when they reform their police services, and especially when they come from mm-hmm. political transition, have to deal with non-state forces that can muster violence, mm-hmm. basically. And as far as I know, Georgia did have some experience yeah. with that. Could you talk a bit about that and some of the strategies that were...
Most of them, they did happen already during Shevardnadze's era. For one reason, he had to monopolize power at the time, so that with the groups that were influential at the time, because we've never had a proper army at that time, different paramilitary groups, so to say, he managed, you know, somehow to dismantle them and then arrest most of the big guys in those groups. But then still we've had remnants of those groups in different parts. For example, in Upper Kodori Valley, I mean, the one guy, a notorious one, Guziani, who was a small king there, for example, and then he held this territory with this paramilitary group that he had, and it took, you know, a bit of a semi-armed, almost an armed action at the time to get him arrested at the time, and then this territory to have been freed for some time until now Russians occupied it. But anyway, so after the revolution already, the big paramilitary groups were already dismantled after the civil wars at that time. So it was not the major problem. They all transformed themselves, the remnants, into the organized crime groups dealing with different businesses and then having their own spheres of influences, and not of paramilitary nature per se, but then well-armed criminal groups at the time mostly.
So the approach to these groups, or at least their remnants, was within the zero tolerance.
Yes, and then the zero tolerance in a way, and then it was again some we frequently critiqued by the opposition on what this new zero tolerance meant. But then exactly the zero tolerance meant zero tolerance to the crime at that time of serious nature, obviously, and all groups that were armed groups at the time of criminal nature, they were pretty much yes under the more zero tolerance approach rather than a lenient approach to it.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.